was quick. Here we are. My name is Juanita Yule, and I'm a member of the Al-Anon family groups. Hi, everybody. You look good. I want to thank you for inviting me to be here with you this weekend. I bring you greetings from my home conference, which is in the mountains of Colorado, and it's called Fellowship of the Spirit. And I've been going to that conference since 93, since the first one. And so I'm really honored to be here, and I truly thank you for the privilege of coming here this weekend and spending this weekend with you. It is an honor. So thank you from the bottom of my heart. Thank you for the goodies. I want to thank my friend Isaac. Tom and I came in on Wednesday and spent a few days with him in L.A., and we also had the chance to have dinner with Jaime and Shelley last night and some breakfast with them, and they drove us up. And just thank you guys for all the service work you do. And I want to thank the committee for all your hard work, because it really is a lot of work to put one of these on. We've been involved in this for several of them, and I've done many of these at home in New Mexico. So thank you. Good stuff. Well, I have a friend who says, I'm only speaking to one person, and sometimes you know who that person is and sometimes you don't. And I only have one story, and I just ask that I'm able to tell the truth. And so, God willing, that's exactly what will happen this evening, is you'll get the truth. I grew up in this little town by the name of Pewaukee. And one of my very first memories is being 5 years old, waking up at my grandmother's house. And grandma's house was this little adobe. And grandma didn't have she didn't have heating, she didn't have plumbing. She heated with a wood stove. Grandma used to cook on a wood stove, and she'd make tortillas, and she'd fry up potatoes, and she'd cook beans on that. Some of the best food I've ever had, I got to tell you. And when I'd wake up in the morning, Grandma would come and wake me with a cup of coffee. And it would be more milk than coffee, you know, but it was and a lot of sugar. And Grandma spoiled the heck out of me. I absolutely loved her. And once I finished my coffee and this little cookie, which we'd call it a bizcochito, she'd say, bueno, mijita, come on, my daughter. Okay, my daughter, let's go to the well, because she didn't have running water in her home. And she'd say, let's go draw some water. And so, you know, I'd put on my shoes, and if it was cold, I'd put on my jacket, and we'd go off and to the well. And we'd walk. It's about 50 feet from her house, and Grandma would take the pail off the peg because it was too high for me, and she'd let me put it over the edge, toss it over the edge. And you could always feel when it hit the water, and we'd let it fill up with water, and then she'd say, okay, let's pull it up. And together, Grandma and I would pull up this bucket of water from the well, and she'd lift it over the lip of the well. And I was always so excited, because I could hardly wait to see what was in this pail of water. Because sometimes in this pail of water, there might be a little water spider, or sometimes there might be a little frog. I mean, you just never knew, you know? And at my house, we just kind of drew water from the tap, you know? It's like you turned on the faucet and you get your water. It's like, how boring is that, you know? But at Grandma's, it was like, wow, this is cool. And that's what life for me was at the age of 4 and 5. 6 years old. It was about anticipation. It really was. I was excited. It's like, what's going to happen today? And little by little, one day at a time, what happened to me was living with somebody's drinking. My dad drank. I won't tell you he was an alcoholic, but I'll tell you his drinking affected me. What happened was that I began to lose that excitement. I began to lose the anticipation for a new day. And I quit talking about the things that were going on at home. And that went on for some time. And then by the time I was 17 and a senior in high school, I found myself married shortly thereafter. I had a daughter. And by the time I was 21, I was divorced with this little girl with whom I couldn't be a mother. I was absolutely not able to be a mother to her. And it wasn't that I didn't spend time with her, but see, all I knew to do was to spend time with the husband that I had at that point in time, my first husband. Until the day came when I couldn't do it anymore. He had a little problem, and his problem was he had an allergy, and it was to work. And so, you know, when he'd go to work and he'd come home after an hour or so, and that was it for the next month. After about 2.5 years, I just thought, I can't do this anymore. Not when I'm getting up and going to work, you know. And so I divorced him. So by the age of 21, I'm divorced. I have a daughter, and I can't be a mom. And I'm going out 3-4 times a week with friends, going to bars, drinking, going to parties, having what I thought was a really good time. Really good time. But while I'm having a good time, I'm absolutely guilt-ridden because I've left my daughter with my mother. And deep inside me, I knew this was not okay to do. My mother became my daughter's mother. I became something like a sister to her. Well, by the time I was 23... I was invited to this wedding, and at this wedding, I saw this guy standing outside the cathedral in Santa Fe, and he looked pretty good. He was dressed in a Madras shirt and these little tan corduroy pants, and he was just cute as could be. And he looked pretty preppy, you know, and he didn't look like any of the guys I'd been hanging out and dating. And I thought, and my little brain started clicking. And by the time Mass was over and we ended up at the reception that day, I found myself standing right across from him as we were going through the buffet line. And I look at him and I just give him this huge smile. I just like, you know, it's like the kind that lights up everything, right? And he was like this scared little deer, you know. He was like, his eyes got big and he got kind of scared, but I followed him to where he was sitting and sat down with him, and I was on a mission, you know what I mean? And I really believe that within 30 minutes of sitting down with him and talking, he told me he was an alcoholic, and he said, I like to do a little heroin every now and then. And I thought, well, this will be interesting. And the little preppy guy that I thought he was, who looked so innocent and so, like, shy and quiet, was like this bad boy, you know? And it was like, this is good, you know? I've never been with one that's like this, so we'll see what's going to happen. Anyway, I found out, like, every place that he went, you know? I found out where he liked to party and who he liked to be with and stuff, and so that next weekend, it was a Friday afternoon. I'd gotten off work, and I showed up at this bar downtown. And sure enough, he walks in about 10, 15 minutes later. And he goes, I can't believe you're here. You know, and I say, hey, how about that? And we kind of like, you know, talked. And then the next weekend we were, you know, I showed up at this other bar, you know, that he was at. And it was like, he was so excited. He was like, this must be fate or something. And I'm like, yeah, must be, you know. And God, poor guy, he didn't stand a chance, I'll tell you. And so within a month, I think, we'd moved in together. It was like, you know, lust, not love. We didn't fall in love, we fell in lust. And I'm really nervous. I really am. I'll tell you right off the bat, I'm really nervous. I don't even know why, but I am. But anyway, so we moved in together. Less than a year later, we were married. And into that relationship, he brought in two boys, two sweet, sweet, lovely boys. They were 5 and 7, and my little girl was 6 years old. And they were so cute. They were all three these little blonde-haired, kids. And shortly after that, we had another daughter together. And this little girl was a little dark-haired girl with blue eyes. And whenever I took them out to the grocery store or wherever, they'd say, "Oh, are you babysitting for these kids?" And it just got easier for me to say, "Yeah, you know, I'm babysitting," because it was just too hard to explain all the relationships. And we became yours, mine, and ours. We really were. We weren't a family. We weren't a family. We were yours, mine, and ours. And it was hard. I'll tell you, it was hard. It was a hard time. And I wish I could tell you that I was a wonderful stepmother, but I was not. I was not a good stepmother. I was neglectful of the boys. I truly was. You know, I paid attention to my girls, and the boys, I just kind of... It's not that I didn't not pay attention to them, because I made sure they were fed, I made sure they were clothed, gave them baths, but I didn't give them me, you know? I didn't give them my attention. I didn't nurture them. I didn't nurture them. And I knew deep within me that this wasn't okay. But it's just like the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous talks about in the chapter We Agnostic, where it says, we had, and I'm going to paraphrase because I can't remember, but it says something to the effect of, we had personal convictions galore, principles, and we had convictions galore, but we couldn't live up to them. We could no more live up to them with our willpower. And that was me. I knew that the way I was treating these kids wasn't right, but I couldn't live up to how I wanted to treat them. It was beyond me. And so that just led to more guilt, more guilt, more guilt. And so I'm going to tell you a little bit about how the family disease of alcoholism progressed in my life, because it is progressive. For me as a family member, the family disease is every bit as progressive for me as it is for the alcoholic. And it's every bit as deadly. So Tom and I had been together for maybe 6 months or so. He was a construction worker. He worked really hard. He was working outside. It was wintertime. He came home. He got into the tub. And he didn't come out. And it was about 2 hours that he'd been in there, you know. And so I walked in, and, you know, he was fast asleep in the tub. And I thought, oh, this poor guy, he works so hard. The water was absolutely freezing in the tub, so I let some of it out, you know, and filled it back up. Not too hot, not too cold, just right. And not too high, you know. I wanted... You know, he worked. The first one didn't. He worked, so, you know, wanted to keep him around. And I went back to bed, and sometime in the night he came to bed. And about 4 years later, I walked into the bathroom again, and he's in there. And by this time I know he's not passed out, you know, because I've been watching him drink. Now, I'll tell you, when we got together, we drank together. We were buddies. We drank together. We drugged together. One story that I'll tell you real quick is that he told me he liked to do a little acid, you know. He really liked to do a lot of acid. And I said, you really shouldn't do that, you know. And he says, well, why not? And I said, well, I saw this movie in high school. And in this movie, I said, you know, this... They end up finger painting in the funny farm, you know, if they do acid. And he said, honey, I've done acid hundreds of times, and look at me. Should have gotten a clue, you know. But, you know, sure enough, I'll tell you right now that I did all that. I did all that. I did every single drug there was to do, and I did them every way there was to do it. Every way there was to do it. Because I needed to be his best friend. I needed to be his best friend. I had to know that no matter what, he would never leave me. Never leave me. And the only way that I could ensure that is to do the things he did. So I did. So anyway, so, you know, after doing all that, and it's now 4 years later, fast forwarding, and we've had, you know, some violence in our home where we had to call the police. My oldest daughter, who was then about 8.5 years old, had to call the police, and they took him to jail. And the next day, you know, he comes home, and I come home at noon, and he's there, and he said, Juana, he said, if drinking turns me into this kind of animal, and that I do what I did to you because I wasn't looking too good. He said, I promise you, I will never drink again. He said, I love you, and I will never drink again. And I knew he meant it. I knew he meant it. With every fiber of my being, I knew he truly meant it. And that night, he was drunk. And you see, I couldn't figure out why he was drunk. You see, I drank a lot. I had a lot. I did all this stuff. And if I could slow down, if I could pay attention to my drinking and how I drugged, why couldn't he? Why couldn't he? I didn't understand the disease of alcoholism. I didn't understand that I had a problem, and I certainly didn't understand that he had one. And I lost all compassion. So I walk into the bathroom, 4 years later, and then I know he's passed out. I know he's not asleep. And I thought, if I could get the local ice company to come and dump its load of ice in there, I'd have done it. Because my goal in life by this time was to make him more miserable than I was. I thought I was more miserable than he was. He couldn't possibly be as miserable as I was. He couldn't be in as much pain. Never, never did it occur to me that perhaps he was more, in more pain than I was. Never occurred to me. So I left the bathroom, left him in the cold water, and I thought, if anything happens to him, I hope it's tonight. So some time went on, and what happened to me is the disease progressed, and I'm starting to think, and I'm starting to pray. I'm praying to a God who I don't care about. I'm praying to a God who I'm really not sure I believe in. I'm praying to a God who I'm absolutely positive is going to send me to hell. So why do I want to believe in this God, right? Let's pretend he's not there. I'm praying, tonight, God, there's this spot on the highway where I lost an uncle in a drunken car wreck. Tonight, that's the spot. He's going to go over. Take care of that. And God didn't do it. Night after night after night, God didn't do this. And I'm thinking, he can't even pull that off. It's like, forget it. So, there's that going on. There's the nights when he comes home in the middle of winter, and there's 3-4 inches of snow on the ground, and he doesn't make it up the front steps, and he falls, and he passes out in the snow, and I look out, and I see him there, and I lock the door. And I think, that's it. Tomorrow morning when I wake up, I'll be the little widow, and I'll be, gee, too bad, And every night, man, he'd make it in, He'd make it in. And I would swear I didn't even give him a key, so I didn't even know how he made it in. And the worst part is that he'd come in freezing cold, and he'd like put his rear end up behind me, and that was like insult to injury, And it went on like this, It went on like this, and worse and worse and worse. And it was so, you talk about insanity. I was so insane that there were days that I would, he'd be drunk, or I'd know he was going to be loaded, and we'd have all the kids at home, and I'd send him with all the kids to do whatever he was going to do. And I'd think, if anything happens to him, if anything happens to the children, then he'll see how bad he is. Then he'll see how bad he is. And I thought, if my kids get hurt, if my kids die, then he'll understand, and he'll like quit drinking. It's like, who's the insane one, right? Who's the one who's crazy? The book Alcoholics Anonymous, in the doctor's opinion, says the alcoholic is in full flight from reality. I'm chasing after him. I'm chasing after him. Who is in full flight from reality? It's crazy. I was crazy. And I was clueless. I was absolutely clueless. I had no idea at all. So a few years more pass. I walk into the bathroom for the last time in the evening, because it was always in the evening that I had, these little bathroom scenes. And he's in there. And I'm filled with so much rage. I'm filled with so much guilt. I'm not a good mother. I'm not a good wife. I'm not a good daughter. I don't like myself. I have those thoughts that I wish I would just, I never thought about suicide, but I wished I would just kind of like evaporate into the air like smoke, you know? Just let me go up into thin air like smoke, because my life isn't, I'm not doing any good with my life. I'm not doing any good in my life. I didn't like the person I was. I couldn't stand myself. I remember one time looking out the front window. And I looked out there, and I looked in my house, and I thought, is this all there is? Is this my life? Is this as much as I get to have? Is this as good as it's going to get? And it's really stupid what came to my mind, but I was remembering being a child and going to, with my mother to work. You know, because she'd have to take these trips for a week, and we'd go and we'd stay in these little cabins in the mountain, and when we got older, my brother and I'd stay by ourselves, and, you know, Mom would go work, and I thought, I will never be able to stay up at a little cabin in a mountain ever again, because we have no money. Every bit of money that I had, and I had a good job. I had a great job, great money coming in. He worked, but we had no money at all. And I thought, I'll never be able to spend another night in a little cabin. And I thought, this is it, you know? And this is just misery. Misery and depression. Misery and depression. And I had no idea. I had no idea how depressed I was. I was barely bathing anymore. If I bathed twice a week before I went to work, it was a lot. I didn't have a smile on my face anymore. And I walk into the bathroom, and I look at him, and I thought, who in the world would possibly know if I were to shove his head under? And I literally watched my hand stretch out over his head. He's drunk. He's a drunk. He passed out. He just slept down. And I truly believe that God came to me in that instant, because I had two thoughts. And the first thought was, there's going to be this. Remember the show Columbo? I hate telling this, I really do, but it's the truth. The Columbo came to mind, and I thought, there's going to be this little cop, you know, like Columbo here in Santa Fe, and he's going to figure out that I did it. And the next thought was, and what happens to your kids? What happens to your kids? You know, their father's dead, and their mother's in the penitentiary, and then what? And I remember leaving the bathroom and shutting the door, and I don't believe I ever went into the bathroom again after that night, late at night. And it made sense to me. It truly made sense to me. It was the solution. It was the only solution. Several years after being in the program, Tom asked me the question. He said, why kill me? Why not just divorce me? I said, divorce wasn't an option. Killing you was the only viable option. It truly was. Because I can't tell you how many times I kicked him out. And I always took him back. I'd kick him out and I took him back. The day came when he said, honey, I'm going to leave. I see what I'm doing to you. I see what I'm doing to the kids. I'll leave. I said, you can't leave me. It's the truth. I said, you cannot leave me. He had become my whole life. He had become my whole life. Our relationship had become the kind of relationship where I was mom and he was one of my kids. I was mom and he was one of my kids. I said to him that day when he asked me, why didn't you just divorce me? I said, why didn't you just quit drinking? Why didn't you just quit drinking? He could no more quit drinking on his own than I could say, our relationship is finished. Our relationship is finished. So anyway, long story short, the day came when he said, I'm going into treatment. And I said, okay. And he and our youngest son proceeded to take trips to treatment centers to interview them. And it's true. And I got a little nervous because this interview process was going on a little too long. And finally, you know, the day came and he said, it's time. I found a place and we're going to go in. And I took him in. And we're sitting there at the treatment center. And they said to him, you're going to have to stay in here for 30 days. And he panicked. And he said, oh, I've got this construction business. I can't stay for 30 days. And they said, well, you can absolutely leave if you absolutely have to. But, you know, perhaps you'll change your mind. And I panicked in that moment, you see, because he'd already been to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he didn't like it. And the treatment center to me was my last hope. It was my last hope. I had nothing else left in my little bag of tricks. You know what I mean? It's like I had tried everything to try and have power over alcoholism. I had tried everything. We'd go to dinner. The waitress would say, would you like a drink? I'd say, no, thank you. I don't think I want anything. And then his drink would come, and I'd say, oh, maybe I'll have a sip of yours. And before I knew it, I'd almost finished his. And he'd order another, and I'd almost finish his again. And I could never figure out why he was so loaded after dinner when I'm the one who drank all the drinks. I had no idea that he was excusing himself to go to the men's room and stopping off at the bar and ordering several double shots on his way there and on his way back. I thought, man, this guy's a real idiot, you know? It's like he just can't drink. I mean, it's like there's times that he drinks and he gets absolutely, like, you know, falling down drunk. And then there's days when it's like he hardly drinks and he's still drunk. You know, and I just couldn't figure it out. But I had done everything by this time to try and have power over alcohol. I had tried to have power over alcohol, and I just couldn't succeed. So, we're in this treatment center, and I'm thinking, this is it. If they don't help him, I don't know what I'm going to do. So he finally said, yeah, let's go. I'll go in. And they gave him this little sheet of paper. And on this sheet of paper, they asked him the questions of what did you drink, how did you drink, how often, what drugs did you take, how often. Yeah, some of you know that form. And I helped him fill it out. And I want to be sure that, you know, he got all the help he needed there. And when we were done, you know, he turned it in, and about 5-10 minutes later they came in and they said, we have this, and we'd like you to fill it out. And it was the same form. And so I filled it out, and I checked off a little alcohol, a little pot, and signed the bottom of it. And Tom looked it over, and he said, wait a minute. There's a lot of stuff you left out. I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, what about the painkillers you used to take? I said, oh, Tom, I said, that was, you know, that time of the month. And he said, what about the speed? I said, I was just trying to lose a little weight. He said, what about the heroin and the cocaine? And I said, get real. You'd never share. And I'm really grateful today that he didn't share, you know, because I might have a different story today. Anyway, I turned it in. And I left that treatment center. And I left absolutely devastated. I truly did. Because I felt like I was abandoning my kid. I really felt like I was abandoning my kid. And I left because I was filled with so much pain. I thought, what happened to me? What happened to that little girl filled with so much hope, with so much anticipation about what's my life going to be like? This new day, how's it going to be? What's going to happen? The excitement was gone, and it was just surviving. I was just surviving every single day. A day at a time, an hour at a time, a minute at a time. And I thought, how did I go from that to this? Anyway, they told me at this treatment center that I had to go to Al-Anon meetings. And I didn't want to go. I really didn't want to go. You know, I was, I didn't think I had a problem. And I thought if he just got sober that I'd be okay. And I finally did go to an Al-Anon meeting. And I sat there and I listened through the whole meeting. And I knew these people didn't have much to share with me. You know, they were housewives and professional business people and old hippies, and you know, I just knew we didn't have anything in common. You know, professional people, even though I was working for the state of New Mexico and I had a good job, I was an accountant, people weren't talking at my office about the things that were going on in my home. I remember coming from a trip down from Mexico one time, and I told him about getting stopped at the border and getting searched and, you know, strip searched and all this kind of stuff. And the look on their faces was like, was shock. And I thought, well, that was a bad idea. And so, you know, I just knew that I couldn't tell people about my life. And I had two lives. I had the life at home and I had the life at work. And the two could not meet. They could not meet. And so I show up at this Al-Anon meeting, and I just know they can't help me, and I'm listening to all these people, you know, share their experience, strength, and hope. And I thought, you poor suckers. You poor suckers. They're talking about God, and I thought, you know, it's like, get a clue, you know. It's like there is no God, and if he is, he's playing you for a sucker. You know, he's treating you like a little puppet, pulling the strings up there. And finally, towards the very end of the meeting, this one woman who was at her first Al-Anon meeting said, how do I get my husband into treatment? And by this time, I'd been to two family days. And after she was done sharing, I raised my hand. And they called on me, and I proceeded to tell her how to get her husband into treatment. I had totally forgotten that a month or so before he went into treatment, I'd woken up from a dream. And in this dream, there was this drunken bum walking, getting out of the gutter. And I realized that that was my husband, and it was alcoholism. And this was my life. This was my life. And I finally reached that place where I could no longer deny my life. It was real, and it was really bad, and it was not, it was just not good. And we sat down and had a little talk, and before we did, I said a prayer, and I said, God, I'm going to talk to him today. And I said, but I've talked to him so many times. And I said, what's going to be different about this time? And I said, you give me the words, God. You give me the words. And so we sat down and had a talk, and I thought God had given me the words, and I forgot I had said the prayer. Never once did it occur to me that perhaps Tom had gotten as sick and tired as I was. And it was just his time. So he ended up going to treatment, and I proceeded at that meeting to tell the poor little girl how I'd gotten him into treatment. And when I said thank you very much, they all said, thank you for sharing. Keep coming back. And in my arrogance, I thought, well, they really value what I have to say. And I thought, I'll keep coming back because you guys need me. He wasn't going to need me anymore, right? So somebody needed me. So, okay, I'll keep coming back. That's him, by the way, right there. Say hi, baby. Oh, God, I was so sick when I got into these rooms, so sick. And I was absolutely clueless as to how sick I was, clueless. When I was bringing him home from the treatment center, I was absolutely scared to death, scared to death. I didn't know who he was. I had no idea who he was. And I didn't know who I was. They asked me a question and they said, nobody had ever asked me this, and it's a question that chilled me to my very core. They asked, what is it you like to do? Well, I could tell you what he liked to do. I could tell you what my friends like to do. I could tell you what other people like to do, even my kids. But I couldn't tell you what I like to do. I had no idea. I had no life. No life. So I'm bringing him home. I don't know who I am. I don't know who he is. And I think he's going to spend a week or two with me. He's going to look at me with these new eyes that are clear, clean, and I'm not going to be enough. I'm not going to be smart enough. I'm not going to be thin enough. I'm not going to be sexy enough. I'm not going to be witty enough. I'm not going to be enough. And every single woman in Alcoholics Anonymous is going to have all the enoughs. Hey, Deanna. And it wasn't going to be me. So I found myself not only going to Al-Anon meetings, but I found myself going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous so I could keep an eye on him. Nothing wrong with this gal. I went so far as one day calling myself an alcoholic so I wouldn't feel so distant, you know, at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I knew it was a lie. I knew it was a lie, but I went. And there were a lot of people, I'll tell you, who heard my story. They heard my drinking story. They heard I'd been thrown in a police car with my hands cuffed behind me. And some of them would say, well, I've never been in a police car. I certainly have never had my hands cuffed behind me. Of course you're an alcoholic. Why would you even question it? But there was something deep inside me that had this doubt, that had this doubt. Even as much as I drank and the things I did, I was doubtful about whether I was an alcoholic or not. 2 years going to Al-Anon meetings, in and out of AA meetings, and not frequently, but every once in a while, I asked this woman if she'd sponsor me. Because you see, after 2 years of going to Al-Anon meetings, I could no longer blame him for what was wrong with me. I could no longer blame him. He was clean. He was sober. He was excited about sobriety, and I was miserable. I was more miserable with 2 years sitting in Al-Anon meetings than I was when he was drinking and using. Absolutely devastated inside. So I asked this woman if she'd sponsor me. And she said, well, let's meet for breakfast. I said, okay. And she proceeded to tell me what her requirements were for sponsorship. And I said, okay, I can do that. And she said, no. She said, I want you to go home and think about it, and I want you to go home and pray about it. And I was so sure that it took me 2 weeks to call her back. And when I showed up at her house on a Wednesday evening after work, I was scared to death to walk into her home. I was scared to death. There was that part of me that knew something was going to be different. Something was going to change about me. And I was scared. I was scared. I was scared to live my life the way I had been. And I was scared to do something different because I didn't know what it was going to mean. I didn't know what my life was going to look like. I didn't know what I was going to look like. But we started working the steps. She said, you're going to get yourself a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. She says, because that's how I take people through the steps. And we're going to read it together. And she says, you're not to read it on your own. She says, because you won't understand a word of it. And I knew she was right because I tried. And it was like reading Greek, you know. And so we started reading this book. And I asked her one day, I said, I'm really confused, Kay. Yeah, this is how I drank, and I drank a lot. And, you know, this is all the things I did. And I said, do you think I could be alcoholic? And she said, well, I think you're going to find out your answer. She says, why don't we just continue through with this book, and let's see what comes up for you. I said, okay. I said, okay. So we did. And sure enough, we got to that place. Because I could identify with so much of it, you know. I mean, I couldn't tell the truth from the false. I realized that I had an allergy to alcohol, different from the allergy that an alcoholic has. What happens to me with the allergy as a family member is that I remembered back when Tom would walk in with a bottle of booze, or he would walk in drunk, and what would happen to me is that my stomach would start to feel like I would imagine a wet wash rag would feel when you're wringing it out. It just felt like my guts were being like twisted, you know? And then it would start in my belly, and then this feeling would go to the back, and it would crawl up my spine and into my shoulders and down my arms, and my hands would turn into fists, and my neck would tighten, and my jaw would do this. An allergy is an abnormal physical reaction. I had an abnormal physical reaction to alcohol, and I didn't even have to drink it. So I could relate to so much of this. I just didn't realize, I couldn't get it through the differences quite yet. But we got to that place where it speaks about the moderate drinker, the hard drinker, and the real alcoholic. The hard drinker, given sufficient reason, can stop or moderate. And that was me. That was me. It's like I could moderate. I could quit for a long time. I could take it or leave it. It wasn't any big deal. What I couldn't take or leave was trying to control Tom. Trying to control Tom. You see, once the alcohol was out of his system, once he was sober, I tried to control his recovery. I started working the steps in the book a bit before Tom did. And so I thought, if I can just show him the light, you know? And of course, we all know it, that's not possible. But I wasn't trying to control the alcohol, so surely this was okay, you know? So I guess what I'm trying to say is, I've had to work these steps so many times, and every time I go through them, I always ask myself, have I been fooling myself all this time? Am I truly an alcoholic? And I'm lying to myself, and it always comes up, no. And that's after 19 years. I walked into my first Al-Anon meeting July 2nd of 1986, and I still ask myself, could I be lying to myself about the fact that I'm an alcoholic? And it's still no. And then I ask myself, am I still as powerless today over alcohol as I was when I first went through these steps? And the answer is still absolutely. And then there's been other things I've taken through the steps. Trying to control his sobriety, trying to control his recovery. The last thing, the last several, and there's numerous things. One of the last things I put through the steps was jealousy. And that's not the last thing, but that was one of the last things. And I tell you this because it's something that I had always seen in my inventories and tried to deny that I had any jealousy. And it was kind of like an evil monster that if I could just deny it, it wouldn't be there. And it didn't matter how many times I put it through the sixth step, and I said, absolutely, I want God to take it. And I would say the seven-step prayer, and I would watch it come up as I, you know, looked at the tenth step, and I thought, God, why haven't you removed it? And I kept going back to the seven-step prayer where it says, if it's of use to God and to others, you know, God's the one who gets to decide what goes and what stays. And I'll tell you that I've watched it since it's been removed, because it has been removed. I've watched that God has used it in many ways. I wish that God wouldn't have found it necessary to use it for as long as he did, but that's the way it was. Well, this last time through the steps, bless you, what I saw was... was the wall that I still build between me and you. I was speaking at a conference in Midland last January, and I was like three quarters of my way through my talk, and all of a sudden I had this thought, tell this story. And it was like, no, we're not going to tell that story. It was like, there it is, sidetrack it, and off we go and do this deal. Well, it bothered me. I sat in prayer meditation that night, and I said, what's up with that, God? What's going on? You know, what did I do? And I remembered the story in the Bible where Jesus is in the garden, and he's talking to Peter, and he tells Peter, by the time the cock crows, you will deny me three times. And Peter says, no, it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. And sure enough, he found himself denying God three times. And what I saw was I saw how I had denied God. I'd gotten a clear message to tell a certain story. And I said, no, I'm not doing it. And that was me denying God. And I said, okay, so what's going on with this? Because there was also another thing that happened when I was at this conference. I like to feel like I've got a real connection with everyone in the room when I'm telling my story. And I didn't feel the connection this day, you know, and I like to feel that there's an exchange between us. I'm giving to you, you're giving to me. And I didn't feel that. So I had those tooth into me. And I said, what's going on? I really would like to know God. And I will tell you that every time I have asked God for an answer, and I truly mean it, I get my answer. every time. I've found for myself that there's two components to prayer. There's the words, and then there's the feeling. And if I really want it, I'll get my answer. Then there's those times that I just put the words out, and I don't get an answer. It's because I don't want it. I don't want it. I want to go with self will run riot. Thank you very much. I'll call in on you because that's what I'm supposed to do, but it's like, stay way over there, okay? So I ask in prayer, what's up with this? Because it didn't feel good that day. And what I got was, you have an amends you have to make. And I knew about this amends for about a month. And through the years, I had gotten a glimpse of this amends. And I would think, okay, you've got to make this. And then it would promptly, like, leave my mind, you know? And it would come up, and then it would leave. And so I finished this talk, and, you know, God says, you've got this amends you've got to make. And I say, okay, I'm going to make it. And I waited for a little while, and it was in the back of my mind. And I went to visit a friend of mine up in Denver, and I was telling him this story. And he said, you've got to make that amends. He said, any time that there is something between you and your fellow human being, there's something between you and God. And you're never going to be able to reach your fellows the way you need to reach them if there's something between you and God. And I knew this. This wasn't anything new. It was like I knew it full well. And he said, you need to go make that. And I said, okay. And sure enough, about a week passed, and the day came that I drove all over town trying to make this amends. And what it was Tom had, I told you, he had a little problem with heroin. And I was working at this clinic, this medical clinic. I was the bookkeeper there. And they had medical supplies, and I saw this box of syringes, diabetic syringes, and I thought, oh, he'd love me if I took this home to him. And I did. And so I had to go and pay this back. And of course, we all know why I promptly forgot it, because I didn't want to do it, you know. And so I went, I tracked down, I had to go to several of the places in town. Finally, the day came that I went and I made it. And I sat down with a gal and told her what I was going to do, and, you know, that I needed to do this, and that, you know, I had stolen it. And she didn't really care, you know, but I sure did. And anyway, it was made right. It was made right. And I'll tell you that I believe that since that day I've been clean. I sat with my sponsor in Maine about this summer in June. And I sat down and did some step work with her. And in this step work, I realized, like I said, that once again, I was building walls. I was building walls between you and me. I thought I had taken down all the walls. I thought I had taken them all down. But what I found with every trip through the step is that it's like this spiral that keeps going inward. And it's like you have this coil, and you take the coil and you open it from one end to another and you stretch it. And there's like the fat end, and then there's the little skinny end at the bottom. And every trip through the steps, it's like I go inner and inner and inner. And I get to find out all those things that I'm not. And it's like I'm talking to the choir here. So it's like, this is like, I guess that's why I'm nervous about doing this. Because, like, you guys do this stuff. You know exactly what I'm talking about. It's like, I'm not telling you anything you don't know. But what I get to find out, and what I found out for myself, is that I'm not a mean, ugly person inside. I'm not a person who is depressed and who is just always sad and who is uncaring. I found out that I'm a person who really loves people. And I found out that I try to be my first line of defense between you and me. I try and claim the position that only God is supposed to have. God needs to be my first line of defense, not me. So I found this out, and I can't believe it. My sponsor, when I sat down with her this day, said, give me your list of, you know, the resentments you have. And I started listing out all these people. And she said, I'm going to stop you. She says, I only want you to pick one. This isn't the way we do this. It's like, come on. Doesn't she know any better? It's like, she's been my sponsor. It's like, have I, like, misjudged her? You know, what's up with this? And she says, you only get to pick one person. Pick one. So I picked one. We search out the flaws in our makeup. I look for the patterns. One person, 20 resentments. Stupid resentments. Dumb resentments. Same resentments that I would have had with any one of those people I wanted to put on my resentment list. When I looked at where I was at fault, same thing that I would have found out for every one of those people. I use me for my first line of defense because I have a heart that wants to love you so much. And because I'm scared to be vulnerable, I'm scared to truly let you see me, I'll hold on to these resentments so I can separate myself from you so that I don't love you so much that I die inside, little by little. It's the same kind of stuff I did with Tom. One of the things I realized when I did some of my sex inventories was, I'll tell you about one of my last sex inventory. I'm going to tell you about what I found out. When I sat down to write my ideal was, you need to be open to this man because you're still shutting yourself off from him. You're not letting him see you for who you really are. All your flaws, be vulnerable with him. All your thoughts, your feelings. See, I was trying to protect myself. If I really got to know him more, if he really got to know me better, if I became very, very vulnerable, then he'd use it against me. He'd use it against me, and I'd be hurt. That was what I've always tried to do. Defend myself, protect myself, so that you don't hurt me. If he finds out something about me, then he'll use it, and then I'll hurt. I put up this tough front, because if he were to leave, if he were to die, the pain I would feel the more I get to know him and he gets to know me would be so bad. I think I'm going to die from it. I think I'm going to die. And I don't want to have that. I would rather leave right now, okay, run. Cut and run. Than to really have somebody get to know me. Old stuff. All old stuff. None of it's new. All of it's old garbage I've seen from my very first inventory. But at a deeper level. A deeper level. I see how the fear that I have deep within me, it just affects me still in other ways that I never thought I'd ever see, that I didn't think existed. I have a real relationship with Tom today. My sponsor still knows me better than he does, but he knows me second best. And I wouldn't change that. I wouldn't change that. I love and respect him today, and I thought that would never happen. There was a day, years before I came to you, that I didn't respect him. I doubted that I loved him. And today I truly love him and I truly respect him. He's a good, kind, caring, honorable man. And I also know that I can see that in him because I can see it in me. And I never could see that in me. I didn't think it was there. I was scared to see it in me. I have a real relationship with my kids today. One of my greatest fears was to be able to tell my kids, especially my oldest daughter, the one whom my mother raised. I was afraid to really be truthful and honest with her because I was afraid that she would get angry and that she would never speak to me. And if she never spoke to me again, then not only would I lose her from my life, but I would lose my grandkids, her children, from my life. So I was having a hard time being honest with her. I'll tell you today, we have a really good relationship. Our kids will call and they'll tell me these problems, and what they get from me is the same things that my sponsees get from me. There was a day when my daughter said to me, "Oh, Mom, don't be my sponsor. You're not my sponsor. You're my mom, okay? Like, knock it off." And I thought, I know I'm not her sponsor. I know I'm her mother. But I don't think there's any separating one from the other. And I called my sponsor and I said, "I don't think I can, like, cut this piece off from me and just do the mother thing." And she says, "Well, of course not." She says, "It's all one." She says, "It's all one." And they still call today, and they ask advice. And they say, "I'm asking your opinion. I'm asking your advice because I've learned not to give it," you know? So they know they have to really ask. And I've learned to, like, give it and quit and step back, which is a big deal. I've watched my kids be devastated. My youngest daughter, who's 26, I'm going to tell you a little bit about my kids because this is a family disease. Our oldest son has three boys. Oh, they're the light of my life. I just love them. And when the first one was born, this son that I so badly neglected called us up one day. Carter was about 3 months old, and he said, "We need a babysitter. Do you think you can babysit?" And I said, "Are you kidding?" I said, "I'd love to babysit." We got to be Carter's first babysitter. I got to give him his first bottle. Our relationship, like, totally changed. They love Grandma. They absolutely love and adore Grandma. My oldest daughter is an attorney. As our Arbutus would say, not bad for a drunk's kid, is what she'd say. And she's a beautiful young woman, and she has two children. And when her kids were born, she asked me to come and be in the birthing room with her. And she said to me one day, "I want to be the kind of mother you are." You see, because I've become her mother. I learned how to be her mother. And today, I truly am her mother. I'm not her friend, although we're friends, but I'm her mother. I'm her mother, first and foremost. And we have a wonderful relationship. Our youngest son lives in New York, and he has two children. And they adore Grandma. My youngest son told my youngest granddaughter a little bit about me and how I used to be when they were growing up. And I was not nice. And she said to me, "Grandma, I don't really believe my dad when he says those things about how you were." She says, "'Cause you're not like that." She's never seen me like that. She's just seen a loving, caring grandma. That's all she knows. That's all my grandkids know. That's the person that these steps and this God has made. The person who I was born into the world as. My youngest daughter, who's 26 and is about to be married in October, when she was 13, she attempted suicide. Tom and I had about 5 years in the program. And if any one of our kids was supposed to attempt suicide, it was supposed to be the older ones who lived with the disease for a longer period of time, not this little one. But she's the one who, you know, attempted to take her life. And when I walked into the emergency room to talk to her, And I said, honey, what? Does it hurt that much in here that you had to do this? And she started crying and she says, yeah, Mama. She said, it really does. It really does. Well, that little girl today has graduated from college. She has a graphic design degree. And she is just the sweetest, most wonderful person. She was about 16, 17 years old, and she had had her first boyfriend. She had him for about a year or so, and they broke up. And I remember her telling me one day, about 2 weeks after the relationship had ended, we were walking down her room down the stairs, and she said, Mom, she stopped me on the stairs, and she said, Mom, she said, I know that a month from now, 6 months, a year from now, I'm going to look back, and I'm going to say, and why was I so upset over this guy? You know, and I'm going to go, get over it. It's no big deal. And she says, but right now it really hurts. And I thought, my God, she's brilliant. You know, she's brilliant. And all our kids are the most incredible parents. We were talking, Tom and I, just last night about how responsible they are. You know, they love their children. They're so good. They're so strong. I think they're good examples. And that's not to say that, you know, they don't have their deals or that they might not need any one of our programs sometime in the future. But my God, we're just in awe of them. We're in awe. And we're in awe of the people who we are today. Never would I have imagined that this is who I would be, that this is who I would like grow up into, you know? And I know that I'm just in the middle of it somewhere, that there's more to be found. And today I'm like that little kid who showed up at Grandma's house when Grandma would say, let's go to the well, mijita, and get the water out. You know, let's go to the well. My life is exciting. My life is full of anticipation. I can hardly wait for the next thing that I'm going to be doing. It's like, what a deal. What a deal. My kids love me. My parents, my relationship with my mom and dad, oh, they're so sweet. They're getting so old. Oh, getting so old. Mom just turned 80. Her third sibling just passed away. And we had her 80th birthday at our house. One of her sisters called me up and said, can we have a party for your mom? And I thought, oh, God, you don't know how busy my life is, and I don't want to take time to do it, but I did it. You know, I didn't want to do it, but I did it. And what I watched was I watched all her brothers and sisters and all my kids come to show up and be there to honor her. And that was the last time that my mother and her siblings got to see my uncle who just passed away this last Sunday. They were so happy because he was the alcoholic. He's like the bad alcoholic, the one that, you know, shows up at every celebration, and he's like the bad drunk. And he's also one I had a problem with. And he's one that I got to welcome into my home and give him a hug and mean it. And mean it. You see, my resentment with him has been cleaned up. I don't have it any longer. It was straight between us. When he passed away and I found out about it, I turned to Tom and I said, you know what, Tom? I'm glad I can just mourn him as a family member and that there's nothing between us. And that I could have had this party for my mother and their siblings, that they could see him full of joy, full of life, and they could all have good memories of him. I'm not the same woman that I walked in as years ago. I get to be an advocate for my parents because they're getting old and they go to the doctor and they'll just like tell the doctor, yeah, I'm okay. You know, and they're like, not okay, you know? And so I get to do that for them. I get to be of service for my parents. What an honor. What an honor. They trust me. They know I love them. I made amends to my mother for being so drunk all the time. And for her, I thanked her for raising my daughter at a time when I couldn't. And she said, well, what else was I going to do? And she said to me when I said I was wrong to, you know, have behaved the way I did and have her worry so much about my drinking and the way my life was. And she said, well, I prayed an awful lot. And I'm going to tell you one last story about my dad. When I was married the first time, I stood at the back of the church with my father. And Dad said to me, when we get up, he said to me in Spanish, antes que te entrego a tu esposo, before I turn you over to your husband-to-be, he said, I want to hug you, I want to kiss you. And I said, okay, Dad. We walked up the aisle, and I said, okay, Dad, without any intentions of letting him. So we're walking up the aisle. Immediately as I get to the top of the aisle, I turn away from my dad. We have the ceremony. And after the ceremony was over, he said, you must be awfully embarrassed of me. And I said, of course not, Dad. Why do you say that? He said, you didn't let me hug you and kiss you. I went to a Catholic girls' school when I was a kid. My parents worked very, very hard to send me to this exclusive school, Catholic school. And I went to school with the daughters of lawyers, doctors. The governor, if he had daughters, usually sent his daughter there as well. I thought I had the wrong father. I thought I should have had a father who was a doctor, a lawyer. Instead, I had a father who had been a construction worker and a father who was a maintenance man at the post office. I also had a father whose drinking affected me. Was I embarrassed about the work my father did, or was I embarrassed about what was going on and the fact that my father's drank like he did and everybody would see him? I don't know which one. I can't tell you which one it was, but I'll tell you that I had shame. So I said, I lied. And I said, no, Dad, that's not true. It has only been recently with this last inventory that I did that I was able to begin to see the depth of the pain and the harm that I must have caused my father. How he must have felt for his only daughter to turn away from him. You know, he was so proud of me. Oh, he was he was floating. Can you imagine the devastation he must have felt? So when it was time to make amends to my dad, I knew I couldn't go to him and tell him, yeah, Dad, I was ashamed of him. It would only cause him more harm. So I would seek my dad out. I would go into his house and I'd seek him out. And my mother at this time was still pretty angry. You know, she was like, he hadn't been drinking like in 10 years, but she was still angry with him. And I'd talk to my mom, and I'd say, well, where's Dad? And she'd say, well, I don't know. And I said, I'm going to go talk to him. And she'd give me that look, you know. And so I go and find him and I sit down with him. See, because what I hadn't given my dad was respect. And I hadn't honored him. So I sat down with my father and I gave him my respect. I gave him my attention and I honored him. And I say, Dad, how was your day? What'd you do? Really? And I'd listen to him. And little by little, as time went on, the day came when I would like pat him on the shoulder, then I'd kiss him on the cheek, and then I'd give him a hug, and then I'd tell him I'd love him, and I'd rub his little bald spot on the top of his head. And our relationship today is really, really good. And he knows I'm not ashamed of him. He knows I respect him. He knows I honor him. He is the sweetest man on the face of the planet. You see, what's happened to my dad is that he's a man who loves to be giving. He's a caring, generous man. He's worked with Tom for the last, 15 years doing construction. Seriously, this summer, up to a month ago, he was up on ladders, building, 79 years old, with his little hammer, and cutting and doing all this stuff. And there was a little incident on the job where a board slipped, and ever since then, 2 weeks later, he quit working. And I've watched my dad, slowly all of a sudden in the last month, really age, get old, So I know his time is coming, and I know my mother's time is coming. And I am so grateful that I've been able to be a woman, a daughter, that my parents today are very proud of and who they love, because there was a time when they weren't. And I've gone on way too long, and I apologize, but I just want to... I'm not the same person. I'm not the same person, and I know those of you who are here are not the same. Every one of us has changed, and it's only a loving God who has done that for me. Done that for me. The steps did something to me that gave me not only a belief in God, but access to and dependence. The longer I'm in this program, the more I need to depend on God, not the less, the more. And I am grateful for that, because I would not want to walk this path without Him. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your attention. God bless you.